Hello, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I'm Carl from selfsufficienthub.com, and I'm here to talk about all things self-sufficiency. Sustainability and food security matters. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I hope you're all safe and well. Today, I have with me another special guest, and today it is Trent Mouchot from The Brew Show. Trent, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Well, as always, what I like to do is start by just saying, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit and tell the audience how we came to be talking today on the subject that we're going to be talking, which is home brewing.
Yeah, so I have a YouTube home brewing channel called The Brew Show, where I teach all things home brewing related. But my main goal is to simplify home brewing so that anybody can get started. So I do all kinds of things from beers, wine, ciders, to non-alcohol fermentations like kombucha or ginger beer. And the goal is just to make anybody feel like they can start brewing today.
Fantastic. Well, that's right in the center of my wheelhouse. that's exactly what I want to get from this conversation, Trent. So we had a home brewer on the show not so long back, and he was very focused on beer predominantly. So I'm hoping that we're going to kind of not necessarily skip beer entirely, but we're going to focus on more of the sort of the fruit-based beverages. So maybe you could start just by giving us a sort of overview of, you know, how the brewing process works. So if we're talking about things like, fruit-based stuff, so wines and ciders, how does the actual process work? Help me understand it.
Yeah, so I always tell people that fruit-based fermentations are probably the easiest way to get into. Beer can be a little more complicated, but when you look at fruit-based fermentations at a very basic level, you have the juice, which is your source of sugar, and then you have some sort of yeast, which will consume the sugar and create alcohol and carbon dioxide. And there's kind of, you know, many ways to go about it. The way that I tend to go about it is I go with store-bought juice. Mm-hmm. And if you go that route, you have to use juice that has no preservatives in it, usually written as sorbates, sulfites, or benzoates. Those will stop your yeast from doing their job. But the other way to do it, it would be to collect your own fruits or harvest your own fruits, and then you would crush those and press those to get the juice out and then ferment with that.
Sounds good. And so please carry on.
No, I was just going to say, and the main thing to know about using your own fruit, if you do go that route, is that you need some way to stabilize that fruit, because there's a lot of yeast and bacteria that tend to live on the fruit, in the skins of the fruit, depending if it's apples or grapes. So if you're going for like a natural fermentation, that's totally fine. You don't have to worry about it. And that can tend to be a little more unpredictable. But some people desire the natural fermentation. But if you wanted to have more control, you would stabilize that with either some sort of either heat pasteurization, or they sell what's called potassium metabisulfite, which is canned in tablets. And that will, it's basically like powdered pasteurization. And it'll stop that wild yeast from growing so that you can then introduce the yeast of your choice to have more desired outcome.
Okay, so there's quite a lot in there to unpack, and I'm
sorry if I threw a lot.
No, not at all. I can feel myself getting quite excited about it, though. So, I've heard of Camden tablets. I've only ever heard them used when you want to sort of stop fermentation. So let's just quickly deal with Camden tablets. Do they basically just sort of kill the yeast dead, whatever yeast it is?
Yeah, pretty much. I believe they stop the they stop them from reproducing. So it won't stop. Like if you have an active fermentation, it's not going to stop it in its tracks, but it will slow it down, keep it from growing, I guess.
Okay.
So it's good. It's good for the wild yeast, because then you don't, you know, you can control that population so that you don't have a bunch of like funky off flavors.
Yeah. And heat stabilization is basically doing the same thing just through heating it up, like pasteurization. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So you could heat it up to something like 150 Fahrenheit, which I think is about 66 Celsius, and hold it there for a few minutes. But the only catch with heat pasteurization is that you are going to drive off some of the aroma and flavor that, you know, might be in the juice.
Yeah, sure. And then you touched on the idea of natural fermentation, and that's something that it actually excites me quite a lot. And I wonder if we could maybe go back to that in a second, because the idea of that's how I make apple cider vinegar. I don't introduce any yeast to it. You know, I just use apple peels and cores and what have you, and some water. And that's how I get my apple cider vinegar. So that, I'm assuming, does that process sound familiar to you as natural fermentation?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's, if you think about like how they used to make cider or wine back way back when, you know, they didn't know what yeast was. So they were just kind of going off whatever was yeast was on the skin of the grapes. Mm-hmm. And so it does give you much more, I would say, a unique taste. It can be, you know, a bit more on like the sour side of things, but it is definitely interesting. It's something I haven't really played with a lot, but I would definitely be interested in trying.
I imagine it would be a much more variable taste because, you know, the yeasts that are, you know, the natural bacteria and yeast that we use to make things like sourdough, they're going to vary from house to house, from environment to environment. And I imagine it's the same with, you know, the yeast and bacteria that's on the fruit outside, and you're going to see quite wildly varying results, one would think.
Yeah, I think if your goal is consistency, then I don't know if natural fermentation is the way to go, but it's definitely, I think, something you could get like either a very unique year, you know, maybe one year you get something very unique that you like, and then next year might not be to your taste, but
sure.
Yeah.
So let's start with cider then. And you said like fruits are, you know, easier than beer. So let's say I've got a big bucket of apple juice that I've pressed myself or that I've bought from the store, either way. What do I do with it? What's my next step? Talk me through the whole process.
Yeah, so when you have, there's a tool that we use in the homebrewing world, which is a refractometer or a hydrometer, and they take the amount of sugars that are present in a juice, and they tell you how much is there. So that is a big driver for how much alcohol you'll get. So the higher that number is, the stronger the drink will be in the end. So usually at the very beginning, you'll take that reading just so you have a sense of where you're at. And if, for say, you wanted like a stronger cider, you could always add in more sugar, which will drive up that number. But just something to consider with adding sugar is that it will also dry out the finish of your beer because there's less, it's less concentrate on the natural sugars. It's a sugar that is very simple that the yeast will consume and eat a lot of.
Right.
If so that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And again, I think I'll circle back around to that in a bit to kind of talk about that in a bit more depth. But before we go any further, I want to talk about the, what did you call it? The refractometer or refractometer?
So there's two main tools, refractometer and hydrometer, and they both do the same thing. They measure the amount of sugar that's present in a liquid. So a hydrometer is like, you can think of it as almost, it looks like a thermometer, but you drop it in a sample of liquid and it will float up or down, and on it there's little markings, and they'll tell you the level of sugar.
Oh, I see. So almost like what do they call it? The marks on the side of a boat that tell you how far into the water it is. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so as your drink ferments, that little scale of the hydrometer will go up. It will rise up, so you'll see. Actually, it'll drop down, so you'll see the numbers change, letting you know. And eventually, when you're at the end of fermentation, you'll see that it stops moving. And that's when you kind of know that you're done fermenting.
Okay. So what sort of numbers are we looking for? I mean, are these your hydrometer and refractometer, are they fairly standard across the board insofar as the numbers they read, like a temperature, like a thermometer, you know, 20 degrees Celsius is going to be 20 degrees Celsius all around the world. Is it the same with these things, or are they more sort of individual?
There's a few different scales that are used. The most common one for homebrewers to worry about is called specific gravity.
Right.
And that's written as like a 1.000 or a 1.050. So the higher that number is, so if a 1.080 would be a really strong starting point, and then usually you're going to end up closer to like a 1.00, so like a 1.
And that's when all the sugars have been metabolized by the yeast, basically.
Yes. Yeah, correct. Okay.
So I've got my bucket of juice, mm-hmm. and I've put my refractometer or my hydrometer in it, and I'm getting a reading. How do I know whether or not I should add more sugar? What's the thought process there? What does that look like?
Well, a lot of times on the hydrometers, they'll give you right next to that specific gravity, they'll give you the predicted alcohol percentage. So you mm-hmm. can kind of judge off of that, see like where you want to be. And, you know, for me, I usually go off of, I'll look at like commercial examples of a cider, you know, sometimes around 5 or 6%.
Yeah.
So I'll just kind of look at that and see, okay, I'm in the right range, or do I need to add more to get into that right range?
Okay. That sounds really simple. And I'm guessing, but I mean, these things are basically like little plastic. That's what I'm seeing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. Yeah, they're like a little bit taller, and you put them into like a cylinder. You can drop them straight into like the bucket of juice, and you'll see it'll float right at the level that you will read at.
So based on that assumption, I'm guessing they're fairly cheap and easy to get hold of.
Oh yeah, they're, I would say probably like anywhere under $10 American.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
pretty cheap.
Yeah, definitely worth investing in if you're going to be doing any home brewing, I imagine. So, but what my goal is from this this interview, Trent, I'm actually being a little bit selfish. Usually when people come on the podcast, although it is very much about me learning, and I enjoy the learning process, I mean, I'm talking to you very much with a view that at the end of this interview, I'm prepared for later this year to make my own cider and my own wine from the grapes and the apples in my garden. So that's going to... my questioning. I hope that's okay.
That's totally fine. Yeah, I'm here to help.
Excellent. So does it matter what type of sugar we use?
It really doesn't. You obviously need to use like a real sugar. You can't use like a sugar substitute like stevia or you know, xylitol, these sweeteners, because they don't have the sugars needed for fermentation. But most commonly I'll just use table sugar, or there's also something called corn sugar or dextrose, mm-hmm. which that is more fermentable than just straight table sugar. So the yeast has an easier job at converting that.
So when you say it's more fermentable and has an easier job, does that just reduce the time required, or is there something else that changes as well?
It just means that, so as fermentation is going on, you eventually hit your what's called final gravity. That's where the yeast are done chewing up all the sugars. Mm-hmm. But depending on what type of sugars are in the juice, there's more complex sugars or more simplified sugars. The yeast will have an easier job eating those simple sugars, which means it'll drive your final gravity lower. And a lower final gravity means you'll have a drier finish to your beer. If it doesn't dry out as much and you have a higher final gravity number, it'll be much more sweeter and much more full body.
Got you. Yeah, it's all making sense. It's all going in. So, can you use, for example, honey or maple syrup?
Yeah, definitely. I use maple syrup all the time as a sugar in my brews. Yeah. The thing about those, and I think honey holds on to flavor a little better, but maple syrup is very simplified sugar. So the yeast will eat that up, and it doesn't really leave much of the flavor behind. So that's just something to think about.
Okay, so we've got our bucket of juice, we've got our hydrometer, we've put that in, we've made our decisions, we've added the amount of sugar that we think is correct. What's next?
So at that point, really, the next thing is just to add your yeast. And there's tons of yeast. You can use, for cider specifically, they have lots of cider specific strains. But you could also use a wine yeast. And you can also use a beer yeast. And the way they kind of differ is beer yeast are more geared towards the starches and sugars that are in beer, which are a little more complex, whereas the wine yeasts are going after more simplified sugars. So wine yeasts are also great for higher alcohol beverages. So anything above like 10%, that'd be great for a wine yeast. But and ciders are somewhere in the middle. They are a good range. They'll eat up those sugars nice. And yeah. I usually, for my ciders, I'll go for like a champagne yeast because I like it dry. I like it, you know, crisp. But you really can't go wrong with anything.
Okay. So you've mentioned four different types of yeast there: beer yeast, wine yeast, cider yeast, and champagne yeast. What mm-hmm. are we looking at when we're shopping for yeast? How do we, not just for cider, but, you know, for generally, how do we go about making the decision of which is the right yeast for what we want?
Yeah. So, each of these companies that make the yeast, they have on their website descriptors that go with their yeast. So, you know, the things that you're often looking out for is the alcohol tolerance. So how much alcohol it can handle before the yeast won't ferment anymore. You'll also look for like flavors. So each yeast, when it ferments, it's creating additional flavors. And they're usually described as esters and phenols. And those are your fruity and more spicy notes. So they're not something you're necessarily getting from the fruit, but you're getting it from the fermentation activity. So you can go on these websites. You can see they have all kinds of spreadsheets of what you can expect out of each yeast.
That's exciting. What were those two names again? Something and phenols, esters and phenols?
Or? Yeah, esters and phenols. Yeah. So esters are more like fruit-based characteristics, and phenols are more spicy notes.
Okay. And what exactly are they? How does that work?
You know, I don't know if I can describe it specifically, but they're just characteristics of the fermentation. Something that happens during the fermentation process that drives these characters. Okay. I'm sure there's a better way to describe it, but
I'll put you on the spot there. I mean, we've gone quite down the rabbit hole there, so don't worry. We don't need to nail every last little aspect. But I imagine that's just done through the actual metabolism of the sugar, because that's all that's really happening, isn't it? Is that the yeast is in there and it's effectively metabolizing the sugar, and as a byproduct it's giving out alcohol and the CO2, which is going to give it, if we want it, our fizz. So
correct, yes.
So I just want to take a moment and say thank you for listening. I really, really appreciate every single one of you who downloads and listens to the show. There's lots of ways that you can help the show grow and support it. And probably one of the best ones is just to share it with someone. Find someone who you think might be interested in this content and say, listen, here's a show that I like. I think you might like it too. And point them in our direction. We would be forever grateful. If you want to go a step further, you could also become a patron. You can do that by going to patreon.com/selfsufficienthub and set up to donate a small monthly amount. If you think this podcast is worth the price of a cup of coffee a month, then you can set it at that amount. And obviously, anyone who chooses to do that, we are eternally grateful to. We're making cider. We've picked our yeast. How do we know how much yeast to add?
On a lot of the packages, they tell you how much yeast live in the packet. So there's some websites, and I can definitely send you some, where it is a yeast pitch calculator, and you type in your original gravity, and then it'll tell you how much yeast you need to use for that specific gravity.
Sort of per liter or per gallon or whatever it may be.
Yes.
Okay. And then, so what's the one thing we haven't sort of mentioned at the moment? We've been talking about a bucket of juice, but that's not really going to do the job, is it? A bucket? We need something different.
No, actually a bucket works great. And you specifically want to look for a food grade bucket, just because you are going to be consuming what's in the bucket. But yeah, I use buckets all the time. I actually have a video where I made a fermenter bucket for under $10, and it works great. I especially use small buckets all the time for smaller fermentations, experiments. So as a starter, I would definitely recommend bucket. Is an easy and inexpensive way to get started.
Awesome. So how do you go about creating the lid? Because obviously one thing, and you know, I'm treading a line here between sort of stating the obvious, but also making sure that for those who aren't aware, you know, that we cover everything. Not in pretty much any type of fermentation, we need to be able to allow the excess the vapor to basically escape and not explode our bucket, don't we? So we need some kind of air filtration system, if you like. How do you go about fitting something to your bucket?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So during fermentation, you create alcohol and you create CO2, which is going to create a lot of off. It's going to pressurize if you have a closed lid. So what you need is a way for the CO2 to escape. And the common way for homebrewers to use is what's called an airlock. And essentially what that is it's a device that has water in it, and it only lets out in one direction. It doesn't let anything in. So that also protects your cider or wine from, you know, any wild yeast or bacteria from getting in. So it lets it CO2 out, nothing comes in. And on a bucket, you know, it's as simple as you drill a little hole in the top, and you can get these little rubber grommets, which I've linked in the video that I made, and you just pop them in there, and they can just pop your airlock in, fits snugly, and you're ready to go.
Perfect. I actually saw a little hack for this, and I wonder if you've got any experience with it or any thoughts on it, but rather than having to buy an airlock, using a balloon, that must be something you've come across. Is that something you would recommend or not?
Yeah, I mean, that definitely, it does the same kind of thing. The only thing with that is that you got to make sure your balloon doesn't get too big, but I don't think you would have a really issue with that. But it does the same thing. It captures the CO2 in the balloon, and instead of it all being trapped inside the bucket.
I've actually heard that this is such a long time ago, and I can't remember where I saw it or heard it, but you actually pierce the balloon with a pin first, you see? So it works so that the actual air does escape. It doesn't just get bigger and bigger in the balloon. The way the balloon works, the air won't ever go back through. I just thought that was a really neat, cheap trick.
Yeah. That's pretty genius, actually.
Okay, so we've got our airlock set up. We've got our apple juice fermenting away. What next? How often do we check it? How do we check it? What does that process look like?
So usually, it depends. So a big factor for fermentation is the temperature in which you ferment. If you ferment at a warmer temperature, you're going to get, it's going to ferment faster, but you're also going to risk getting more of the off flavors that might come from stressed yeast. So usually I recommend people, especially starting out, is that you find a nice, probably the coolest part of your house to ferment. And also you want to keep it out of direct sunlight, but if you're using a bucket, usually that's not an issue, but, sunlight is like the enemy to most fermented products because it'll tend to skunk it and make it have some off flavors. So just set it in a cool, dark place for about a week and you should have fermented apple juice by the end of the week.
Wow. Just a week. and then we use our hydrometer. Do we, at that point, just throw that in and that tells us whether or not we're there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's give or take a week. The cool thing about the airlock is you'll
start to see it bubbling up,
and then you can monitor it. And like every day, you'll see it eventually start slowing down, and eventually it just stops. That's kind of a good hint to let you know that you can go ahead and check the final gravity.
Perfect. And at that point, it's just a case of bottling it up. Do we need to let it sort of cure at that point, or is that it? We're done.
Well, one thing I wanted to talk about first before we get into bottling is sanitation, which is kind of a big aspect of home brewing. A lot of the mistakes that I made early on was not caring so much about sanitation.
Yeah.
And there's a simple product that you can use that homebrewers use all the time, and it's called Star San. It's an acid-based sanitizer, and it's something that you would want to use throughout the whole brewing process. So it's something you would you make like a solution with water, mix it with water, and you put it in the fermenter. And it basically just kills off any of those extra maybe wild or microorganisms that might be present, so that you have the cleanest fermentation. And then you would use that all the way through. So anything that touches your cider, your juices, should be sanitized just to prevent an infection from going on.
And the name of that product again was Star San?
Star San, yeah. And there's other ones. There's some iodine-based ones, but I recommend Star San.
Okay.
Pretty readily available.
Yeah, and just basically give your bottles a good go over and everything a good go over before you touch it with your cider.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and is it ready to drink straight away or should it be left after that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, you could definitely drink it straight if you like it, especially if you like it something more still. You could just, you know, put it in the fridge and drink it right away. But if you wanted something sparkling, more bubbly, you would have to do what's called priming. Which I'll try and explain in the simplest terms, essentially where you add in additional sugar and then it creates a secondary fermentation inside the bottle. So when you close up the bottles with extra sugar in the apple juice, it'll continue fermenting, creating more of that CO2, which will then build pressure in the bottles and you'll have a bubbly cider.
Yeah, that all makes perfect sense to me. I don't actually drink, but I do make kombucha. So that process, that process makes perfect sense to me. So the idea of a second ferment to get that fizz. So
yeah, yeah.
So you're talking about wine. Process. Talking about wine then, moving on, and mm-hmm. with wine is basically the only two things we're going to change, that we're not going to have a second ferment unless we want sparkling wine, and that we're going to change the type of yeast. Is that the only two differences?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they are very similar. I guess the one thing you would want to consider is if you wanted to do a white, you know, wine versus a red wine. And those are kind of dependent on your grape choice and as well how long you leave the grapes on the skin. So grape skin contact is a great impactor for your tannins, which is kind of the, gives you that mouthfeel, the kind of like cat tongue mouthfeel that you get in red wines. Yeah. And then it also impacts color greatly. So the longer it's on, the darker the wine you'll get.
So is the color of the wine influenced by, is it simply a case of green grapes make white wine and red grapes make red wine, or am I oversimplifying it?
Not always, because you can still make a lighter white wine with a red grape. It would just be taking the juice from the grape skins and getting rid of the grape skins as quick as possible. And if you wanted to make like a rosé, it would be like, you let the grape skins be on there for a shorter amount of time and then take them off before they give too much color.
Okay. So talk to me about this skin procedure then, because how am I, if assumedly I'm going to sort of crush the grapes up mm-hmm. and we're going to leave the skins on in the fermentation bucket, or what's the process?
Yeah, exactly. So you would just leave them on and they'll tend to float towards the top of the fermenter as you ferment. So you'll need a way to push them down to kind of keep things mixed to make sure everything's getting fermented. There's a great YouTube channel called the Home Winemaking Channel. And he does a lot of these fresh wines from grapes. And he's got some great visuals there if you need more info on that.
Okay. And then after, a few days, we might decide to take the skins out.
Yes. Yeah. So for that, you would want to do what's called racking, which is essentially just transferring from your main fermenter into a secondary fermenter. And that is usually like a glass carboy, because wine likes to age a little bit more. I would say you can drink cider very quickly, or wine, it needs a little time to age and develop those flavors.
And how do we do that? What are we actually doing at that point?
So you're just transferring into a second fermenter, somewhere where it can sit longer and just kind of settle out and clear.
Okay. And what's the purpose of the second fermenter rather than just carrying on in the first one?
It would just be to get it off of the skins. It would just be get the juice off the skins.
Okay.
So if you're not doing that, you could totally keep it in the main fermenter.
Got you. And the same process at the start, you know, we put our hydrometer in, decide how much and what the alcohol content we're sort of aiming for, and add mm-hmm. sugar accordingly and go from there.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we move on to the sort of basic cider and winemaking tutorial you've given me?
Well, I would just say, like, you don't have to start out using the grapes. You can also always start out with grape juice, which is what I tend to do a lot, and it definitely simplifies the product. I would say it's not as like nuanced as a wine made from grape, because grapes have the tannins and stuff in the skins and the seeds. So if you're making a juice wine, you could always add in, they sell like powdered tannin. That's something you can always add. Or if you want like a thinner, drier wine, you just use the juice. And I've made like some sparkling wines recently. I made a rosé recently that was really good. So you don't always have to go for grapes if you want something more simple.
Sure. Well, from my point of view, I'm actually coming at it completely the opposite way around. I've got a huge grapevine in my garden, and it makes little tiny grapes with seeds in. So they're almost impossible to eat, but they are delicious, and I'm after a use for them. So making wine, I think, might be the perfect use for them.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I would say that's the same for like apples too. A lot of time apple juice makers will just, or cider juice makers will just find the apples that don't sell in the stores, you know, the ones that aren't as the prettiest, but they're a little smaller, a little more tart. They make great cider.
Yeah. Well, we're spoilt for choice for apples here in the UK. They are growing everywhere. So you think that's it? You think I'm ready to go now with the cider and the wine? I certainly feel like I am.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It may sound like I threw a lot of things out there, but when you really think about it, it's just juice and yeast, you know, and you just need a place to ferment it that's clean.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. So I did pre-warn you that I was going to be asking mead, because yes. I've had a couple of questions in the Facebook group about mead, because I said I was going to be talking to a home brewer. And I do understand that I'm kind of putting you on the spot a little bit, because you're not a mead brewer, are you? But you did very kindly say that you'd have a go. So yes, first question, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I'll try and bring my knowledge from other fermentations to help out.
Fantastic. So the first question I've got is, mead. I've brewed loads of fruit and vegetables successfully, but my mead would not brew. My only two failed batches were Ribena and honey. Any tips for mead?
So when I think of a stuck fermentation or a failed fermentation, the first thing that comes to my mind is the yeast health. A lot of times meads tend to be a little bit higher as a starting gravity. So they're a little bit stronger. There's more sugars there and the yeast can easily get overpowered. So the first thing I would look at is the yeast count. How much yeast did you pitch? You know, do you need to pitch more? Oftentimes for my stronger beers or ciders, I need to throw a lot of yeast at it. And then secondly, I look at in correlation to the yeast health is the yeast nutrients. I don't know for sure, but I'm like a lot of simple sugars or things like honey. I don't know how much nutrients they actually have to support the fermentation. So adding things like there's certain yeast nutrients that you can buy. They're online, just called yeast nutrient, but they're also called dionium phosphate, which is a nitrogen based yeast nutrient. And there's also one called Fermate O or Fermate K. And that is essentially dead yeast that you feed the yeast and they kind of support a healthy yeast fermentation. So I would say definitely look at your yeast health.
That makes perfect sense to me. That makes perfect sense. So the second question that we had regarding mead was, I was told by someone it is better to boil the honey water mix and then let it cool before adding the yeast to sort of sterilize the mead in such a way that no other organisms taint the mead. Is this true?
So I would say from my experience, and as we talked about, especially on juice wines or juice ferments, you definitely do want to start with a sterile starting place so you can control the fermentation, but I'm pretty sure that honey is antimicrobial. So I don't know how much wild bacteria and yeast are living on it. So I don't necessarily know if that's needed, but I would say that adding warm water would definitely help loosen up the honey and make it a little easier to work with. But I don't know that sterilizing is needed for that.
No, that does make sense, because honey is basically sterile and it will last forever.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's great. Thank you for answering those, Trent. And finally, definitely. And the last thing that I wanted to sort of touch on is just general troubleshooting tips. And, to save me calling you up later on in the year when I'm making my cider, are there any general troubleshooting things that I can be aware of?
Well, the first thing I would say is get a good notebook and write everything down, right? Your start date, your original gravity, try and take good notes, because that'll be your guide as you go forward. You start fermenting more to look back and be like, you know, what worked, what didn't work. And then really, I mean, the internet is your friend. Like there's a lot of great YouTube channels. There's great blogs. There's great magazines like BYO or the Home Brewer Association. They put out articles on fermenting different things. I would definitely reference those. And yeah, you can always hit me up and I'll try and help you out.
Fantastic. You might regret saying that. So before we go, Trent, is there anything that we didn't cover today that you wanted to talk about or that you think we've missed?
No, I mean, really, I just want to restate that, like, it can seem kind of intense at first when you look at all these, you know, pieces of equipment or fancy things. But really, when you get down to it, you know, anyone can start fermenting. You know, even if you wanted to go buy a bottle of apple juice from the store and sprinkle in a little yeast, at the end of the day, you're going to have some kind of cider. It might not be the best cider, but at least it'll get you started, get your foot in the door, and you can start growing and fermenting new things.
Fantastic. That's brilliant. Well, it's been an absolute joy to have you on, Trent, and I certainly 100%, I'm not just saying this, I feel far more prepared for my cider making journey later on in the year than I did just an hour ago. So thank you so much for that.
That's great. And maybe someday I'll come visit you. You can give me some of that homemade cider.
That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome. So why don't you let people know where they can come and check out your stuff?
Yeah. So I'm on YouTube at The Brew Show. That's B-R-U-S-H-O. And I'm also on Instagram at The Brew Show. And I also have a Discord server if anyone is interested in that. It's kind of like a little blog group where homebrewers can chat, post questions, and a lot of people can answer, not just me. So it's a fun place to be. So pretty much everywhere, The Brew Show.
Brilliant. Thank you ever so much for that. And thank you for your time today, Trent. I do appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Cheers.
If you find this podcast valuable, there's several ways you can support it. The easiest of which is to rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. You could also talk about it or share it wherever you post online, including your social media pages. And now you can support the podcast directly by becoming a patron at patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. However you support the podcast, we really appreciate it. Thank you for listening. See you soon.